That's the undisputed master of the screaming trumpet, John Faddis, with Into the Faddisphere. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, July the 31st, and a packed program that we've got to get started right away. First up is a really interesting little story. It's a big story, actually, about a little political action committee with a big idea that there is no room for big money in elections. And with that in mind, we had introduced to you on the 16th this little political action committee calling itself Wolfpack. We talked about it then, that it was the idea that was launched. And then on May the 22nd, we reported that it had scored a victory in Vermont. Today, a coordinator with Wolfpack, Todd Jagger, is with us. He is the coordinator for Texas and Western states, and he tells us that another state has signed on. Todd, welcome to Lead Stories today.
Hi, Eutrice. Thanks for having me back. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Good news to report. Tell us about it.
Absolutely. Well, you know, when we passed the resolution in, or the brave legislators in Vermont passed the legislation to call for a convention under the provisions of the Constitution to propose an amendment to remove the corrupting influence of money from our political process. A lot of people said that Vermont, oh, it's little, it's tiny, it's a little state. You know, they're kind of a rebel state anyway, you might say. They're very independent. Sure, you got Vermont, but, you know, Vermont, right? Well, and you'll never get a state. You'll never get a bigger state. You know, it's just not going to happen. Well, we went to work, and lo and behold, just a few weeks ago, California, the largest state in the country, 60 times bigger than Vermont, passed the resolution calling for a convention to propose an amendment to remove the corrupting influence of money in our political process, and specifically to deal with the disastrous Supreme Court decisions of Citizens United and related issues.
So, now, tell us about the significance of Citizens United, because this is at the base on which the Political Action Committee revolves.
Yes. There's been a long history, actually, in this country of the ascension of corporate and non-person rights as opposed to living and breathing people rights, and none of those have been as detrimental to our way of life, I believe, here in the country as a few of the decisions, notably Citizens United, which allowed corporations and wealthy individuals, billionaires, and unions as well, to spend unlimited amounts of money to influence our electoral process. And so what happened after that was, you can even see some really amazing graphs of just the money exploded into our political process. And it has drowned out, literally, the voice of the people in preference to the voice of the few. It's an oligarchy, basically. Princeton had a study talking about the fact that we now live in an oligarchy here, where the wealthy control the political process and the decisions that are made. So Citizens United actually is just one. It's the one that most people have heard of. It's been in the consciousness of America for the last, 4 years now. McCutcheon also, which was very recent, strengthened, I guess you might say, that ability of unliving people to spend a lot of money. It removes caps on how much somebody could actually spend directly contributing to a political candidate. And so, but there's other decisions as well. I mean, there's ones that, like Bilotti, which is, I think that's the one that said corporations have First Amendment rights, and so therefore they have freedom of speech and can spend in elections. So there's a lot of, you know, disastrous Supreme Court decisions where they've just taken this kind of wrong turn away from the people's rights and to non-living people's rights, or non-living rights, corporations and unions. And so that's kind of the banner for what we're working under. But certainly we're addressing, you know, we need to address everything to get free and fair elections here in the United States again.
Well, you have 32 more states to go. Could you explain the math behind getting a certain number of states in order to get this free and fair elections amendment into law nationwide?
Sure. Yeah, we've got one on the East Coast. We got one on the West Coast. Now we just have to, like a coloring book, fill in all the middle parts, right? So, the math. According to the U.S. Constitution, there are two ways to get an amendment. I know I've said this before, but maybe some viewers or listeners aren't familiar with it. But according to the U.S. Constitution, there's only two ways to amend it, and one of which is two-thirds of Congress can propose an amendment, or two-thirds of the state legislatures can pass a resolution calling for a convention to propose an amendment. Either way that is done, no matter how the amendment gets written and proposed, it still has to go back to the states for 75% of them to ratify or approve whatever is written. So we have two on the board, so two-thirds of the states passing these resolutions is 34 states. So we have two down and 32 to go. We are active in almost every state at this point, so we're not so little anymore. I believe that we are up into the hundreds of thousands of supporters signed up to help us, and tens of thousands of volunteers all across the country. And we're just working. It's a state by state basis. Every state has its own state leader. Every state, because legislatures are a little bit different in each state, we have a battle plan, so to speak, for individual states. So when you call or when you sign up at www.wolf-pack.com and sign up to volunteer, we'll put you in touch with your state leader in your state, and they'll bring you in and get you up to speed on what where we're at legislatively in that particular state and how you can be effective to make this happen in your state. And that's really one of the beauties of what we're doing here, is that the math to me is really, I'm glad you used that term, because it really does come down to kind of a giant math equation. And something as historical and significant and seemingly impossible task as amending the U.S. Constitution really boils down to people taking action on a very local level. And that means you going and talking to your own state representative and saying, you know what, this is a problem. And more than likely, they're going to agree with you, right? And so they want to hear from you. And so when you talk to them, you are making that case, and you are creating someone that will support that in the legislature. And just by doing that in your own local neighborhood, that expands out into the entire state and into the entire country. So as I like to say, you know, your call to your state representative or senator might be the one call that gets that person to support us, and his vote on the floor might be the one vote that we need to pass it in our state, and your state might be the 32nd state to come on and actually make this thing happen.
What is impressive about Wolfpack is that, number one, it's fairly recent in terms of its organization and its entry into the fray, but it has picked up a lot of speed. It is a grassroots movement, and it is gaining ground because people are taking this very seriously. And it is a really refreshing thing to report on something that is conceived this way as a really people's movement that is gaining ground on something so important. And I wanted to highlight it to bring to the attention, because we talk all the time about what's wrong. And it's time also to tell people about solutions to things, where people are in their own fashion working on solutions to problems. And this is a refreshing story to tell in that regard.
Absolutely. The You know, it really is. It's a grassroots movement, and it's really interesting how it has taken off. You know, the Udall Amendment was proposed in, I believe it was 2011. I could be wrong about that, but it's at least a year or so old. And lo and behold, once Vermont passed their resolution, here's Patrick Leahy of Vermont on the Judiciary Committee pushing to bring that to a vote in the Judiciary Committee. So they are looking at what we are doing. I mean, there is no question about it. And even if somebody believes, which I personally do not, that Congress is the best place to write an amendment to the Constitution, from my personal view, I would trust 10 random people off the street to write a constitutional amendment than I would some, you know, most members of Congress. But even if you believe that Congress is the right place for that, then history has shown that the way you get Congress to act is by the states calling for a convention to propose an amendment. In fact, most of our amendments actually did begin with the states calling for a convention to propose them, and that includes the Bill of Rights and four of the last 10. So this is absolutely the way you make this happen. And it's a lot of people come to us because exactly that they see that what we are doing with this effort has actual real consequences. We're not saying, pretty please, Congress, you know, or state legislators pass a non-binding resolution that, you know, asks Congress to do something. We're actually, the resolutions that we get passed in the state have binding and legal consequences. And when you get 34 of them to call for a convention for this specific issue, now it can't be an open, you know, we're not calling for an open convention. This is a specific one topic issue that the convention would address. And when you get 34 states to call for this convention on this specific issue, then it happens.
Now, Todd, how can people learn more about Wolfpack?
Simply, you can certainly email me. I'm glad to field emails. My email address is Todd, T-O-D-D, at wolf-pack.com. And but of course, you can also go to the website, www.wolf-pack.com. And you'll see, if you click on states, you'll be taken right to a map and a list of states, and click on your state and get active. We will put you right to doing the things that will actually matter. And over the course of working in the various states thus far, we've really figured out what is the most efficient and effective use of your time as a volunteer. And so we're not going to waste your time getting you to do things that don't actually lead to real, tangible results. And so I can assure you that. I mean, because we're all busy. You know, I'm busy, you're busy, we got all stuff to do. But, you know, if you can take a few minutes a week, maybe just to, or even just to, you know, 5 minutes and make a phone call and a half hour and go meet in your district office with your local representative, and, you know, their districts are not that big, so that district office is probably, oh, you know, a mile or so from where you actually live, you can take that time. You will be making a huge impact and moving this whole process forward and one step closer to ending this corruption that we have in our government and getting the government to represent us again. I mean, isn't that what it's all about? I mean, they, you know, it's supposed to be a government of, by, and for the people, not of, bought, and sold to the highest bidder. So that's what you can do, wolf-pack.com.
And that pack is spelled P-A-C, no
yes,
K.
P-A-C, yes. wolf-pac.com, yes.
Thanks, Todd, for being with us. Todd Jagger of Wolfpack. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Therese. And I enjoyed the jazz before I came on, by the way.
Thank you so much.
We'll see you next time. We'll see you in state number three. How about?
Oh, great. I can't wait to hear about state number three coming aboard.
Me too. Well, it's going to be soon.
Thanks so much. We'll be back right after this break to talk about media madness and just craziness going on in the Middle East right after this. Pepe Escobar is a Brazilian journalist who has lived in and reported from disparate locations all over the world. London, Paris, Milan, Los Angeles, Washington, Bangkok, Hong Kong, you name it, he's been there. He writes a column, The Roving Eye, for Asia Times Online, and works as an analyst for Russia Today and Tom Engelhardt's TomDispatch.com, and a project of the Nation Institute, as well as Al Jazeera and The Real News. He is focused on Central Asia and the Middle East and has covered Iran on a continuous basis since the late 1990s, and also has been reporting extensively from Afghanistan. He is the author of three books, all of them on geopolitics, the most recent of which is Globalistan, How the Globalized World is Dissolving into Liquid War. Also, he has written Red Zone Blues, A Snapshot of Baghdad During the Surge, and Obama Does Globalistan from Nimble Books. And it is our pleasure to have this renowned journalist with us today. Thank you, Pepe, for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure.
Thank you. You know, In a way, this is your formal introduction to the Lead Stories audience. And I say introduction because I am hinting here that you will be back several times to bring us up to snuff on these very complicated stories that you write about that can't be dispatched in a very brief interview. So consider this your introduction to our audience here today.
Thank you. Wonderful, wonderful.
So I want to start with what is going on now, the madness in Israel. I want to use your most recent story, the one you filed yesterday, titled Israel Gets Away with Killing Civilians While Russia Gets Framed for Killing Civilians. Could you tell us a bit about the anomaly here hinted at in your headline?
Wow, I would need an extended take on Dostoevsky meets George Orwell, of course. But essentially, the new Cold War, Cold War 2.0, started already a few months ago. It's a project by neocons in the U.S., of course, by sectors of the industrial-military complex, by sectors of the financial elites as well. The number one objective is to cut off Eurasia integration, especially integration between Russia and Europe, especially Germany in Europe, and between China and Europe as well. That's the Chinese project of New Silk Roads. So when Putin was talking about free trade area from Lisbon to Vladivostok, which is one of his rolling calls for the past 3-4 years. And when the Chinese talk about new Silk Roads from Sichuan province in center of China, let's put it this way, to the Ruhr Valley in Germany, this is Eurasia integration, trade deals, transportation links, high-speed rail, you name it. They are the new Silk Roads as we speak. No more camels, no more months crossing from Xi'an to Istanbul, for instance. Now you can do it in 2 weeks, and it's even shorter than if you go by sea. So Eurasia integration, this is what China and Russia especially are viewing for the future. This means that America is not going to be the number one star player in Eurasia anymore. Not that it was before. If we look at what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan, this was the beginning of the end. But the fact that America is not going to be controlling or harassing or organizing or disorganizing everything that happens in Eurasia, for a sector of the American elites, let's not generalize, of course, this is anathema. So this is what we're watching now. Cold War 2.0, it's about that. Preventing integration between Russia and China and Europe. And that's why we have many so-called best and the brightest in the U.S. talking about the possibility of a hot war sooner rather than later. And even some people in Russia, the Russian intelligentsia, in fact, started talking about it. And Ukraine as a battlefield. I have been writing about this extensively for the past 2 or 3 months, especially, because now it's dawning on many people, even in Russia, that the kind of appeasement policy that they were trying vis-a-vis the European Union, because Putin was always thinking long term in terms of trade and commercial relations with the EU, it's not working. Because the, as the Russian elite sees it, they are being cornered by the Americans, and the Europeans are also being cornered by the Americans in the long run. So whatever Russia does vis-a-vis the Ukraine or vis-a-vis their sphere of influence in that area, Central Asia, Russian Western borderlands, the Caucasus, etc., they will be sanctioned, they'll be demonized, and Putin now is the new Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, Yasser Arafat, you name it. You need, always the same old story, you need a puppet that is always pictured as this golem Frankenstein who's going to ruin our peaceful gardens in the Western free world. So now it's Vladimir Putin. So now I expect some reorientation of official Russian policy. It could get much uglier, in fact, because the Russians never wanted to invade the Ukraine in the first place. This is a NATO myth. But now, looking at the way the... It's a sort of slow-motion ethnic cleansing of Russian speakers, Russophones, and Russian-linked population in the Donbass region. We're talking about 8 million people, which they consider themselves basically Russians, not Ukrainians. And Ukraine itself is it's now a failed state, of course, but in the beginning was never a totally unified state. The differences between Western Ukraine and Eastern Ukraine are gigantic. You know, they cannot be bridged. Until what happened in the Maidan in February, it was a simmering situation, and now it exploded completely. So a return of the Ukraine that we had after the fall of the Soviet Union is impossible. The next step is, are we going to have a civil war that is going to engulf NATO against Russia in Ukrainian soil, which is the most horrible scenario? Or we could have some sort of political accommodation, which would mean a sort of federalist Ukraine. And this is what the Russians have been saying from the beginning. Regions are autonomous enough in Ukraine, and religion is respected, ethnic conflicts don't develop, it's possible to still have Ukraine as a unified entity. Otherwise, it's going to be civil war. And the civil war has already started, in fact, because what Kiev is doing, they are bombing their own people inside their own territory. If this was happening in a Western country, you can imagine the reaction from Washington, Paris, and London. But it's happening in the Western borderlands, so we have to support the bombing of Ukrainian civilians by a Ukrainian government. It's George Orwell once again, the world upside down.
And what is the parallel as it relates to Israel?
Well, the thing is, what Israel is doing in Gaza, which the way they try to legitimize this operation in Gaza, which, by the way, was planned in advance, months before the disappearance of the three Israeli teenagers. This is something I confirmed with Israelis themselves. You know, they tell straight away, we were just waiting for a prince. Obviously, they cannot tell that on American prime time or to the New York Times, the Washington. But if you have sources in Israel that are inside their industrial military complex but don't necessarily agree with what Bibi is doing, they'll tell you straight faced. So we know this from Israelis. The pretext came up, and what Bibi wanted to do in the first place, which was to smash Hamas, but smash Gaza as a whole. 48 hours ago, they were distributing leaflets in Gaza, urging 400 residents of northern Gaza to simply flee their homes. So they're depopulating areas Gaza. They are bombing people into submission. It's a known fact that has to be recognized by everybody, especially in the U.S., that they are bombing civilians. There was a slip by BB, talking in English, by the way, saying we are hitting civilian military targets. You know, they know, everybody knows it. The Israelis know it. The Arab world knows it. The GCC countries, the petrodollar gang, they know it. People in Europe, they know it. So Americans have to recognize that as well. So, okay, so it is war crimes. Bombing civilians in any circumstance, bombing schools and hospitals. And why do they do it? Because they can. Because they can get away with it. Because you have Obama, Cameron, Hollande, Merkel, and Renzi sitting together like they did on a video conference this past Monday, discussing what to do regarding Gaza. And in the end, they decide to punish Russia. This is the one of the craziest instances of international relations I've seen in my 30 years of journalism covering geopolitics. It's completely crazy. Not even a declaration saying that, look, we're really trying to get a real ceasefire in Gaza, or we're really trying to show to the Israeli government at the moment that what they're doing is counterproductive. They're going to be further and further isolated on a global basis. And this is what's going to happen. It's a replay of apartheid in Africa. The boycott against Israel is good. Even I have a lot of Jewish friends in three continents. Most of them are progressives. And they are appalled at this situation. So, Israeli public opinion and being held hostage by an extremist right-wing and frankly genocidal government like this cabinet is completely crazy. They are burying themselves in the long run. And some are starting to notice in Israel itself.
Well, today, of course, we learned that the Obama administration has agreed to supply more weapons at a time that Israel has accounted for more than 1,300 deaths and more than 6,500 people seriously wounded so far, Palestinians seriously wounded so far. And it seems that there is a problem in the United States as well, in that there is an overwhelming sense that government, the administration and Congress are basically doing whatever they want to do, whether people object to it or not. And the opinions of Americans really aren't important at this time, whether people feel that the government ought to be allied with a regime that is committing these atrocities or not. It seems to be completely unimportant and even incidental to the administration and to Congress.
It's true, and it's not discussed in mainstream media. You won't see a debate like this in the New York Times, the Washington Post, or the big networks, not to mention CNN. Everybody knows outside of the U.S. in informed circles how AIPAC controls the U.S. Congress. This is not going to change. So it's basically an extension from Tel Aviv. Essentially, it's not going to change. The fact that they are authorizing extra military support, $225 million, if I remember correctly, this week, as we are watching the carnage in Gaza, it's beyond appalling. There's no justification for that. If this was a responsible U.S. Congress, and the fact that it's not, that it's rate in America itself is less than 10%. So it's a bunch of crooks, essentially. So American voters themselves don't respect these people. They should be striving for a ceasefire and for some sort of political dialogue involving not only the UN Security Council, but powers in the region as well. But if you can get Egypt on the same table discussing a peace plan for Israel, Egypt is working with the BB government. You know, they don't want Palestinians. They don't care about Palestinians. Not to mention the GCC petrodollar gang. It's the same thing. They haven't done anything. They are not even financing people in apart, obviously, from Qatar, because Qatar and Muslim Brotherhood, it's their official policy, so they support Hamas. But it's a drop compared to the Israeli military power. So the conflict is asymmetrical. It's completely uneven. Of course, the only method that Hamas has is to defend themselves is to... hard or lethal equipment that Israel has. It's on a scale of 100 to 1, you know. But you can sell this as an equally asymmetrical war. No. It's people in Gaza, 1.8 million. Now, it's a cage come concentration camp. They are depopulated from their own cages. So they live under tanks. 400,000 this week, plus 100,000 this past 3 weeks. So it over half of the population still will be living where? In some grasslands in the Gaza Strip. It's impossible, obviously, for Israel to publicly, tacitly recognize what is the, and I'm going to employ a very hardcore term now, their mini final solution for Gaza. It's basically to expel the population somewhere. They can even buy the sea, we know, because it's a concentration camp with a sea barrier as well. So would be to transfer all these Palestinians, 1.8 million, to Jordan. And Jordan would be an absolute Palestine majority country. Already is. It's over 60%. So it would be 80, 90%. So this is the plan. And who has a minimum of a conscience all over the world, everyone is appalled because everyone is impotent to fight it. Israel holds all the cards. This Bibi government, especially administration, holds all the cards. Anything Russia does, obviously, because over there the game is much more complicated, wide-ranging, and it's about the control of Eurasia as a whole. Not only a strip near the Mediterranean.
Well, you certainly have planted a new series of thoughts here in how to look at this geopolitically as a broader issue, a much broader issue than just localized in the Mideast or localized in Asia or localized in the United States or localized in any other part of the world. But it is now coming together as a kind of integrated, as you call it, a new war of sorts, that the world is gravitating toward an inevitable world war of sorts.
Well, we hope, of course, the population of the whole planet, I would say, we hope we're not going this way, but... I remember a few months ago at the Davos Forum, a lot of people were discussing that this is 1914 all over again. At that time, I thought this was absolutely stupid because basically they were referring to China and Japan in the South China Sea and the North China Sea. Not different in terms of if we have now we already have Ukraine as a NATO ally. The next step could, and it's not improbable in the next few months, NATO deploying nuclear missiles to Ukrainian territory. For the Russians, this is beyond a red line. The response is going to be really hardcore. It's not going to be Putin like this past few months trying to appease the Americans and the Europeans, calling for a political solution for Ukraine from the beginning. This is what the Russians have been doing from the beginning. I heard this from Lavrov himself many times. Now it's different. Now they're starting to see that what some sectors of the American elites really want is a conflagration. And if it's in Ukrainian soil, it's going to involve the Europeans against the Russians. The Americans will be watching from afar. You remember the Iran-Iraq war from 1980 to 1988? It's absolutely the same thing. They were more or less not... but they were giving information to Saddam's side, and at the same time, they were passing some selected information to Iran, And they had a stalemate that lasted for 8 years. So it was Muslim against Muslims, and the Americans were, from the outside, just as controlling the whole thing by remote control. This in Ukraine, easily. And some of the best minds in the U.S., like Professor Stephen Cohen from Princeton University, he's absolutely convinced that this could turn into a hot war in a relatively short time. Like Dmitry Trentin from the Carnegie Center in Moscow. The same thing, I was reading one of his speeches yesterday, which I plan to deconstruct. He was more or less saying the same thing. So it doesn't look good. And the mechanisms that we have, especially in the UN Security Council, they are not enough to prevent something like this. Because as we know, when the U.S. wants to bypass the UN Council, as it did many times, they have no qualms about it. NATO is being lifted up to be, and this is for years now, a kind of global Robocop. This is something I wrote about a lot, and especially after the NATO Lisbon summit. And now they're going to have a summit next month in Wales, where one of the top items in the agenda is how NATO is going to develop its relationship with Ukraine. So expect a Russian counterpunch after that. So it's horrible. Now we're going to have an escalation. So we're slowly returning towards, you remember the MAD situation, mutually assured destruction during the Cold War. We are some kind of MAD too. MAD too, let's put it this way. Horrible.
Well, Pepe, thank you so much for this wonderful introduction. And we will take these issues little by little in the ensuing time that as your availability allows, and we'll walk through these subjects in greater detail. But I just wanted to thank you so much for being available today and to bring us to a realization that this is not a simple and isolated problem.
Definitely not. Thanks very much for having me, and I hope the conversation keeps going.
Thank you so much.
Very serious situation. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take a break and come back to our next segment discussing how President Clinton earned $48 million. Wow. It's a very interesting development as of yesterday, and I thought it would be important to discuss it today. A story broke yesterday. It did not get very much play, I don't think, at least considering the enormity of the story. And it's the Clintons being the Clintons. What can I say? Judicial Watch, which is a watchdog group in Washington, D.C., had subpoenaed records and documents of the State Department last year via a lawsuit under the Freedom of Information Act. And what they got back was interesting. It showed that while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, her husband, through a contract with a company, a kind of middle company, middleman company, was able to rack up a very lovely, a tidy little fortune of $48 million while she was Secretary of State. Chris Farrell is the Director of Research and Investigations for Judicial Watch, and he also is a member of its board. And he's here to tell us how they uncovered this very salient fact. Thank you, Chris Farrell, for being with us today.
It's great to be on with you. Thank you very much. We've pursued stories like this now for going on 20 years. Your listeners may recall that we're the same folks who exposed Bush 41's relationship with the Carlyle Group while his son was serving as president. And so now we move along in time and we see a relationship where the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and her husband, the former president, also seek to monetize, that's probably a good way to express it, to monetize their or trade upon their official position. And so we have the sitting Secretary of State in a conflict of interest procedure where her husband's activities have to be screened and approved by an ethics officer. And, of course, only in Washington does the concept of an ethics waiver make sense.
Well, could you walk us through how it is that how do you find out that about this $48 million? And,
sure.
And how was he able to earn $48 million while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State and in a
right.
clear-cut
and
conflict of interest?
Yeah, and so in order to allow or in order to prevent some sort of obvious, well, there already is a conflict of interest. Let's just accept that there is one. There's no way in the world you can have these two officials operating and they would be at odds with each other. But so the former president is out making speeches and going to various public events, conferences, seminars, et cetera, for corporations, for very large banks, foreign investment organizations all over the world. And he's making these speeches, and he's being paid rather handsomely. And so there's over 200 events that he'd gone to around the world, China, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, UAE, all over. And whenever he goes to one of these events, he's supposed to submit a notice to the ethics officer at the State Department who's supposed to, I guess, deconflict or approve of these activities. And of all of the various submissions made, not one, not a single time was the former president ever told no or asked to defer or asked to postpone. They simply provided the notice, and he collected his check. And it's a pretty extraordinary arrangement. And thankfully, we have all the documents. We post all of the documents on our website at judicialwatch.org, so your listeners can go and read for themselves and see exactly what sort of things the former president was up to and how Secretary Clinton's staff, notably Cheryl Mills, signed off on them and said, go ahead, do it.
Well, I had imagined that a story of this magnitude would have consumed media attention.
Yeah, I would think so, too. I recall that the Carlyle Group and Bush 41's relationships, just like Cheney and his relationship with Kellogg Brown & Root, KBR, those stories certainly got lots and lots of attention. But somehow there's a thundering silence when it comes to Mrs. Clinton and to Mr. Clinton.
Well, now that you have uncovered this, this $48 million paycheck, a series of paychecks,
yes.
What happens now legally? Are you suing? Is there a lawsuit somewhere in the works? Is there a request for an investigation and possible prosecution?
No. You know, our objective was simply to uncover the records and the documentation. The relationship that was developed, the legal mechanism for making these disclosures, were a condition of then-Secretary Clinton's appointment as Secretary of State. So the process, the mechanics under which this was done, were all, I'm using air quotes when I say this, were all perfectly legal, whatever that means. So it was a regular process, and they've made all the disclosures as they were required to. Now, people may find it objectionable, or they may find it offensive, but that's a political calculus. That isn't a legal one. Our objective was to make the records public so that people would be informed about what exactly was going on. There's a second entire question as to whether people are offended or find it unacceptable.
Well, considering that USA estimated in 2013 that Bill Clinton's net worth was about $55 million, this $48 million payout does take on particular significance, doesn't it?
It does, and I think particularly in light of Hillary Clinton's claims that they were dead broke, which I don't think anybody quite buys, but you know, she made that statement a few weeks back when she released her latest book. it just doesn't line up. And I guess, you know, no one says that they're not entitled to make a living, certainly. You know, life goes on beyond the trip to the presidency. But this just seems to be a pretty blatant sort of trading on one's office. You know, this is above and beyond, I think, what anybody would expect.
Well, I'm stunned by the amount, $48 million
I'm stunned by the thundering silence.
This is amazing.
You are the only radio show I have done on this subject. Not a single other media outlet has contacted me for comment on this, which I find maybe even more disturbing than the $48 million.
Wow. I wonder what the what might be revealed about Mrs. Clinton's travels at government expense as Secretary of State, and the work of the Clinton Global Initiative and business ventures and the like that developed as a result of the contacts while she was Secretary of State traveling at government expense.
Yes, and that's an interesting tidbit there. When you look at the records, the documentation, there's a number of different entities that Mr. Clinton operated under. So there was the one that's sort of obvious, which is the Clinton Global Initiative. Everyone's sort of familiar with that, and they know that that's his nonprofit operating arm. But he also conducted travel and gave speeches and conducted various activities under the title of WJC LLC, a limited liability corporation. So there's any number of different hats Mr. Clinton was wearing, all of which obviously accrued to his substantial benefit in the millions of dollars. So it's 1,017 pages of records we obtained. They're all on the website at judicialwatch.org. And some of it's rather tedious, I'll be very frank. A lot of it's just sort of forms. But there are really some very interesting nuggets tied into those 1,000 pages or so.
What would be some of those nuggets?
I think not only just the extent of Mr. Clinton's travels, but his relationship with large banking interests like UBS Wealth Management, Wells Fargo, his relationship with foreign entities, both in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. He had quite a globe-trekking, globe-trotting lineup. I mean, there's months in there where he is, from Rio to Jihad to Switzerland to Omaha, Nebraska, you know. It's quite a circuit he's been running.
Wow. I mean, apart from this business, the mechanisms of checks and balances and the ethical reviews that normally would occur did not occur in this situation, as you said, not in one single instance in more than 200 situations where they should have done an ethical review. Does this mean that Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton are therefore exempt from or immune to the suspicion that they should have themselves insisted on a clearance?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously the various, I'll use an old Soviet term, you know, the organs of the state, organs of the state are going to be enormously deferential to a former president and a sitting secretary, and I think everyone would expect that they're going to be very sort of gentle or delicate in how they deal with both of these folks. But that doesn't mean that they should be dishonest, you know. And there really needs to be scrutiny, and there needs to be an instance where, you know, Mr. Clinton collecting a paycheck in China may not really serve the interests of the United States directly, or it may send a very mixed message where we're trying to send a strong message to China on anything from human rights to various trade or financial practices that they engage in. And as Mrs. Clinton should be sort of leaning down or bearing down on them and saying, look, you know, you need to comport yourself with with certain norms and standards of behavior. You know, he's showing up at a trade show and collecting a few million dollars for giving a 20-minute speech. It's just unseemly, and it's also it doesn't serve the interests of the country. You can't reconcile the two.
Well, this has been, to me, this is a bombshell. I am just aghast at the fact that this isn't the talk of the United States at the moment, especially considering the political climate, and especially considering the past of the Clintons. They've had, how could I put it, they've been ethically challenged over the years.
You're being very generous, yes.
Yes, I'm being very nice. And this should have... sent an incredible shockwave through the newsrooms that this is $48 million of free money simply because, well, you got it like that. You got connections and it could happen. It puts to shame further shame all of this talk you hear from Hillary and Bill about, merit things happening on the up and up and, being above board and transparent and all that other kind of stuff. This was just an incredible thing. And it is shocking all the more that you said to me today that this is the only program that has actually called you about the story. And it's amazing to me.
Well, it's the truth. I was waiting for the phone to ring, and like I said, there was a thundering silence.
Thundering. Well, we will follow up certainly on this story because I know there's a lot more in the documents that will come to light, and you can be assured that I will follow up.
Well, thank you very much.
And thank you so much for being with us today and bringing this incredible story to light. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope that it was of value to you. I'm understanding I got some feedback from folks on leadstories@gmail.com that there was a lot of interference when we had our friend Pepe Escobar talking. So I'll check into that to see whether, in fact, that was the case. It was a little scratchy when I heard it in some portions. So I will check on that and we'll see whether we can fix that or not the next time around. But thank you so much for being with me today. Coming up next is Occupied Territory America with Mike Fader. I do wish you would let me know how these programs are resonating with you at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. Tomorrow, of course, it's Free Your Mind Friday, and we look forward to that. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.